Hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Okay. So I'm going to talk today about thinking about the evolution of multicellularity. And so I'm going to start just by saying that there's this famous statement which appears with ever-increasing frequency. And it sort of relates to what Christian was saying at the beginning of his talk.
That's actually an American biology teacher.
What?
You know, there's a version of evolution population genetics where we're mostly worrying about fitness and populations and structures of genomes, the sort of thing that Mike has been talking about. But there's also the question of the things that do all these things, whether by adaptation or by drift, are organisms, and it would be sort of nice to understand how they do it. And so I actually was looking this morning to try and track down a unique origin of this phrase. So there's a paper of Mike's that says, where instead of biology, it says population genetics as the heading of one of its sections. A number of people have said this, and I haven't yet found, and I think, like lots of evolutionary things, this has actually been invented independently by multiple people.
But it is sort of what we're trying to say with evolutionary cell biology, right?
Yeah, and so I almost put as that the title of that slide, evolutionary cell biology is. And I guess in a sense I would often drop the word cell out of the middle and just say it's all of evolutionary biology, and you know, we could have quite an interesting debate about at what level should we discriminate something called evolutionary cell biology as opposed to trying to apply this concept to all of biology. And different people probably think different things about it. And as I said, and so I'll say it very briefly here, you can study evolution in the field, you can study evolution in theory. We're experimentalists. We don't really know how to do things outside the lab. And so we do things in the lab that lead us to speculate about what might have happened in the real world. But it's extremely important to point out that nothing that we do is ever going to unambiguously tell us about what happened in the real world. We're trying to sort of produce ways that people can think about problems and ask whether they're supported by at least some set of experiments. And this is the TARDIS, but you've already seen the TARDIS. So. Okay? And so what I'm going to talk about is investigating multicellularity in two different ways, and actually this part is backwards in the sense that this is what I'll talk about second. But one way of approaching problems is, I forget, I think it was Mike who showed the famous Feynman quote, "What I cannot create, I cannot understand." It was found on his blackboard after he was dead, so it's not clear he actually managed to do it. But it's essentially the same idea that if we think we understand something, we ought to at least be able to build a facsimile of it. And so that will be the second half of the talk. But it's essentially, it's testing hypotheses by reconstruction. It at least partially, depending on how expansive you are in your engineering, defines some space of possibilities, ways that you could think about solving things. And at least for some things that we've done, and I guess this will come back to the first part a little bit, it lays the groundwork for experimental evolution. In other words, if you can engineer strategies A, B, and C by which you can get your organism to solve some problem, and you now take an unengineered version and you ask it by the accumulation and selection of mutations to solve the same problem, does it follow any of those engineering trajectories or not? And if it follows more than one, what are the relative frequencies? And at least in principle, you can go back afterwards and track down the genes that have been mutated to cause the phenotype, that is the solution to your what was originally an engineering problem, and ask, if you know which engineering strategy in some broad sense it followed, can you understand how the mutations in those genes led to cells adopting that strategy? And then experimental evolution, where we make fewer preconceptions. It's really important to point out that everyone who does experimental evolution has preconceptions because the experiment is designed in some way. and that way in which it is designed typically partially defines the possibilities. It sometimes, as in the example I talked about on Tuesday, defines it less than you'd thought, because there are strategies that organisms can adopt that solve the problem that you weren't smart enough to think of beforehand. And in this case, both of these are limited, obviously, by human ingenuity. The experimental evolution is limited by organismal cheating. That is, you have some sets of types of solutions that you hope organisms will follow. That is, ones that are interesting to you. And there is the possibility that they can instead follow ones that are less interesting to you, which means you didn't design the selection to be tight enough. So I'm going to talk briefly about multicellularity. And so these guys, and this one actually has a scale bar, this is basically colonial Chlamydomonas. So Chlamydomonas is a unicellular green algae. It has two flagella. It does breaststroke. And so this organism is just a slightly organized collection, as far as we know, which is not very far. There's no division of labor between these cells. They're all expressing essentially the same set of genes doing the same biochemical functions.
Is the blob swim?
Yeah, the blob swims, right? And this is a bigger blob that has inspired many people, which is Volvox. And so these cells and these cells are about the same size. Okay, so this is shown at lower mag. This is also, this is a ball that swims. And now there is division of labor, because these are somatic cells that will eventually die. And this is the next generation of germ cells, and they're actually already starting to go through division and differentiation. And this is Homo sapiens in all its glory. Okay? And so there are three aspects of multicellularity, two of which we'll talk explicitly about, and one of which impinges on actually both parts of the talk. So the first is, it's just the agglomeration of multiple cells. Okay? The second is that, depending on the particular form of multicellularity you have, and I'll come back to that in a little bit, it can be lineage restricted. That is, that the things can go through bottlenecks, which ultimately reduce to single cells being the transmitter of genetic information between rounds of multicellularity. Okay? And I've shown a particular form here, which is eggs and sperm. And this slide is a bit of a cheat, because these are Xenopus eggs, which I used to work on and are pretty, and these are human sperm, so you can't actually make organisms out of these two things. Okay? And the last thing that's not inevitable, because we believe it doesn't happen here, is division of labor. Okay, so this is just a mammalian neuron as an example of one of the many different types of cells that exist in vertebrates and perform different function. And so the second half of the talk will be about division of labor and differentiation. Okay. And so these are the different forms of multicellularity. So for example, if you're budding yeast, this is a cell. It gives rise to two daughters. And one of the things that will be relevant later on is these cells have a cell wall. It's a complicated cross-linked mesh of carbohydrates. It's about 100 nanometers thick. And after the cytoplasm has divided, that is, they've done cytokinesis, they are still held together by a communal cell wall. And you have to dissolve a specialized part of the cell wall between the mother and the daughter here to produce this separation. So one form by which yeast can become multicellularity is you just fail to divide that specialized part of the cell wall. So even though these are separate cells, that is, they have separate non-communicating biochemically cytoplasms, they're held together by these shared cell wall parts because they're not dissolved, and so you can make clumps that way. And if you do this, you will have lineage-restricted propagation, because even if this clump or a much bigger one breaks in half, eventually, by the breaking in half of all its successors, you will eventually be able to trace your lineage back to a single cell that was in this clump here. And so that's an example of lineage-restricted propagation. And this is the
option. Do you actually do that physically, or do they get to the size where you can't really tell who's basal cell.
In some of the clumps I'm going to show you, you just can't even begin to tell. I mean, in principle, so you can do this thing that we do sometimes where we react a cell with a chemical dye, and then we quench the dye, so it's... And because all the cell wall in this cell is synthesized de novo, this cell would stay labeled and this one wouldn't. So in principle, we could actually do that and look and see where the founder cell is in a clump. We've just never done it. And the other thing that happens is this thing called flocculation, where the cells are not held together chemically by or covalently by a common cell wall, but they express the molecular equivalent of Velcro, that is lectins that bind to carbohydrates on the cell surface. And so in principle now, cells from two different lineages can stick together to make a clump of cells. Okay, and in the circadian oscillator that I talked about on Tuesday, it is this sort of stickiness that makes clumps, not this sort of failure to divide the common cell wall. And so one of the questions that has interested evolutionary biologists and I should say one other thing. The multicellularity has evolved many times independently in the evolution of life, both in plants and animals and fungi. There are people who try and estimate the number of independent origins by looking at phylogeny and applying parsimony. And those estimates are that this property has arisen more than 20 times in the history of life on Earth. Okay, so here's one model or one hypothesis for why things become multicellular. Given that these cells are typically 5 microns in diameter, this is an exceedingly small fish, but it's some yeast predator, it has a mouth, it can eat yeast. If the cells clump together, they're too big to be eaten, and they survive. And this is a reference to a paper, this is an experimental evolution paper where people took a single-celled alga and they passaged it in the presence of a protozoan parasite which can ingest and eat the alga, and after they did this they saw multicellular forms. So, and the belief is, although as far as I know it wasn't rigorously tested by experiment, that was the selective force in that experiment that gave rise to multicellularity. Okay. Here's a second sort of argument, and it's about the use of public goods. So the white here is the cytoplasm, the gray is the cell wall. This blue molecule is a hydrolase. This is some form of complex polymeric nutrient which is too big or complicated for cells to import directly. The hydrolase reduces it to its monomeric form. And the problem is, if you start to worry about the physics of diffusion, more than 99% of the molecules are going to go over here and escape into what, at least in three dimensions, is an infinite sink from which they will never return. And only about 1% of them can be captured by an importer that is lodged within the plasma membrane and taken into the cells and used as nutrients. And so if that's true, what will happen is the cell is a source of the monomer, and if you solve the physics of diffusion, you use Howard Berg's beautiful little book about random walks in biology, the concentration at steady state, because you're escaping into this infinite sink, of the hydrolyzed molecule, which here represents the monomers there, will fall off as 1 over R. And it may be true that this cell is just incapable of importing enough nutrients to sustain growth and division. If it was stuck to its relatives and they do the same hydrolysis and diffusion, it's still true that this cell in the center can only capture 1% of the nutrients that it releases by hydrolysis. But it can also capture 1% of its 6 neighbors' hydrolysis products. And as a result of that, it's better nourished than this cell, and maybe that allows it to grow. And so maybe this is one reason that multicellularity could have evolved. It's a more efficient way of getting flux of nutrients from your environment. And so this is John Koshmanos, who was a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory, and he wanted to ask the question of, does nutrient capture select for multicellularity? And so this looks very much like the diagram that I just showed you. But now, instead of showing a notional molecule, this is a real molecule. This is what you put in your coffee if you add sugar. It's sucrose. It's a disaccharide. This is glucose. This is fructose. Yeast cells, at least as they exist in our laboratory strains, cannot import sucrose. Okay? And so what happens is they hydrolyze the sucrose to glucose and fructose. The enzyme that does this, invertase, is lodged within the cell wall. And so they get, using specialized hexose transporters, to transport glucose and fructose into the cell, but most of it, again, escapes. So the question is it true that there are circumstances under which single cells are insufficiently nourished and clumps of cells are nourished well enough that they can grow and divide? And so John Koshmanos, who did this work, comes from an engineering background, and so he wrote mathematical simulations to look at this problem. And all the parameters in those simulations, most of them come from the literature, a couple of them come from measurements that John did, because he was, either there weren't literature values or he wasn't sure they were correct. And so it's a free parameter, free simulation. That is, there are no free parameters in this simulation. And so John's prediction was that single cells cannot form colonies at low sucrose concentration and clumps can. And I'm just going to show you very quickly that he tested that prediction. And since Christian mentioned ecology this morning, I will make the same point that he did. So we work on an organism that's been extremely well characterized in a laboratory. We know essentially nothing about its natural history. And what the initial yeast geneticist did was to tame the wild beast. And part of it is that as yeast is found in the wild, and this picture is a serious cheat. I used to believe that this bloom you see on the surface of grapes is yeast. That's not true. You only find yeast inside damaged grapes in vineyards, but I couldn't find, it's hard to make a picture of that. And so the founding parents of yeast genetics domesticated yeast, and in particular, some of the natural strains are clumpy, but they wanted each colony that appears on a plate to come from a single cell, and they essentially, by the sort of breeding that agricultural people have done over the generations, bred that property out of yeast. Okay. And again, this is the strain that Christian mentioned this morning. So RM11 is a wild strain that was sequenced and has been used for a variety of sort of analysis of the difference between domesticated and wild yeast. And these cells grow as clumps, okay? The standard laboratory background, we use W303, which was created by Rod Rothstein, grows as single cells, and these are their little buds attached to the single cell. These two strains, this is not RM11. What this nomenclature means, this is W303, but with the allele of this gene AMN1 that exists in RM11 engineered into it in replacement of the version that exists in W303, which differs by 3-point mutations from the version in RM11. The two strains express different fluorescent proteins, so they differ in only two ways. They have one or other of the alleles of AMN1, and they're either red or green, and you can see that the replacement of the AMN1 allele converts these guys into multicellular clumps. Okay? But not all the cells are multicellular. You can see single cells as well. And so what John did...
Can I ask just for...
Of course.
So going back, like, just how dynamic these clumps form and reform,
so he's not going to stick to these guys, but he's going to make a bud, And that bud, my guess is, on average, is much less likely to separate than it is in these cells here. One of the questions that we're actually sort of profoundly interested in is how clumps like these break apart. And for example, the simplest possible model you could have is that every junction, every shared cell wall between a mother and daughter had some unit probability of dissolving over time, okay? And if you looked at a model like that, it would predict that the clump size would be very, very heterogeneous, right? And in some of the things that I'll show you in a second, that's clearly not true. And it suggests something more interesting might be going on. In this case, it probably is true that it has some very long tail. But it's not something we know much about, and I think it's an interesting question.
You go there with static cultures?
Now, these guys are shaking. These guys are shaking.
So wouldn't you think that eventually the guys on the inside would start to get starved?
Yes, indeed, and we'll come back to that a little bit. So David Nelson, who's a theoretical physicist, had a student, Max Lavrentovich, and he and John collaborated to do theory and experiment on that particular problem. And so they investigated what the properties are that affect the depth of penetration of nutrients. And it turns out to be very different for reasons I have to admit that even having read the paper they wrote, I cannot usefully recapitulate to you, to be very different for things like E. coli and yeast. So for E. coli, the penetration depth, if you had a clump of them, is sort of 2 or 3 cells in. For yeast, it's substantially higher, and the prediction is you have to get to be about 1,000 cells in a clump before the guys in the middle are seriously starved. Okay, so here's the experiment John did. So he's going to deposit cells in microtiter dishes. So you can think of these as just miniature test tubes. And he's going to use a fluorescence-activated cell sorter so he can, A, count the number of objects he's depositing, and B, he can select on their size. Okay? So, and these are all these strains where we re-engineered the wild allele back in so they can make clumps. Okay? So the first row of wells is going to get 30 single cells. So he selects the small fraction of guys who are single cells. And they're wild type for SUC2, which is the yeast genetics name for invertase, the enzyme that hydrolyzes sucrose. This well gets 30 cells, but now they're deleted for that gene. This well gets a clump of between 15 and 30 cells, because that's the precision with which John can measure their size using the fax machine. These guys are wild type for invertase. These guys are mutant. So the prediction is, these shouldn't grow because they don't have invertase. These shouldn't grow because they don't have invertase. And these shouldn't grow because they're single cells, not clumps. So now we're not going to shake. They're just going to be dropped to the bottom of the well. Okay. And so here's what it looks. So each row is just 8 replicas of essentially exactly the same experiment. These are single cells that have invertase, single cells that don't have invertase, a clump of cells that do express invertase, a clump of cells that don't express invertase. This is 8 millimolar sucrose, and this is the only well where you see significant growth.
But they're just one cell in each, in the left column, wasn't just one cell?
No, no, there are 30 cells in here. 30 single cells. Right, so this is what it looks like in sucrose, so you can't see what we did here because the cells are invisible. This is growing them in 4 millimolar glucose plus 4 millimolar fructose, which is actually half as much carbohydrate as was in here, because if we just hydrolyze this, it would be 8 millimolar of each. Now, everyone grows, and you can see we put single cells into these wells.
And the guys on the left column, they're not making it because they just can't latch onto the...
They can't suck in enough of the stuff that they hydrolyze. Eventually, if you wait long enough, stuff grows because this is not infinite. And the experiment that John did in collaboration with people in Dave Waitz's lab who do microfluidics. So if you encapsulate a single invertase-producing cell in a droplet has a diameter of about 50 microns, it grows just fine. Okay? And it grows just fine because now the sink's not infinite.
So So these are liquid cultures but not shaken?
Yes, exactly. There's about 100 microliters of liquid in each of these wells.
So you end up with, I mean, on the right, they look like little colonies.
Right, because they're single cells that, what happened is the fax machine spat the cells in. The cells fell, right? And because they're small, although they eventually fall, they don't fall completely straight. And so each one of these things is a colony that arose from a single cell, right? And so if you like, this is the proof of the pudding that
so
these
like
really
the
were single.
The bottom of the dish, the cells fell to the bottom of the dish.
Yeah, and the bottom of the dish is flat.
And little colonies.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's little enough flow and the cells are big enough relative to the flow that everything doesn't get just homogenized. Okay? So that's one way that you can engineer cells to grow in low sucrose concentrations. John showed that if you substantially increase the expression of invertase, you can also get single cells to grow. So you're not capturing a higher fraction of the glucose and fructose you liberate, you're just liberating more. And last but not least, you can so what I haven't said so far is that when cells make invertase, they actually make two forms of the enzyme. One is secreted, and the other is kept within the cytoplasm. Okay, they're biochemically different. One has a signal sequence, one does not. So if you could import sucrose, they could metabolize it. Okay?
Why would it have the second enzyme if it can't import the sucrose?
Indeed. Right? So remember, this is yeast as domesticated by people. Right? So you can, there are enzymes, so you make beer from maltose. You make rum from sucrose because you make it from cane sugar. Okay? Maltose is a disaccharide of glucose, and naturally occurring strains have maltose importers, and some of those maltose importers can bring in sucrose. Okay, and so what John did here is to just put those importers under a different promoter so that we could import sucrose, right? And you can obviously ask the question, wouldn't this be the better strategy for cells to have adopted anyway? Why hydrolyze sucrose on the outside and have all these problems? And we can talk about that if people want. Okay. So these are three strategies. These all, you know, all of these are engineering strategies. They all work at some level to allow single cells to grow from low densities, from low concentrations of sucrose. And so then the experiment that John wanted to do, come on in, was to ask, what would evolution do? So the experiment here is, he inoculates low densities of cells into low concentrations of sucrose. They don't grow very well. So initially, at the beginning of the experiment, it takes about 2 weeks to see appreciable cell division and proliferation. The hope is that a mutation arises that proliferates better, and that when you dilute the culture, you get lucky enough to include the mutation. And it's, you know, this dilution step is a particularly useful way of explaining genetic drift to naive audiences, because you have to make it through the dilution. And so the actual experiment is 500,000 cells get put into 50 mils of 1 millimolar sucrose, and at least for yeast, this is a low cell density. 10,000 cells per mil is low. They're allowed to grow to high density. John washes and counts them. He puts them back. Every so often, he freezes a sample, okay? And like I said, initially, in the first passage, this takes about 2 weeks. It gradually gets faster, and by the end, it takes about 2 days. And the other thing I should say is, to make things go faster, these were mutator strains. So they have about 100-fold elevation in the mutation rate. And so this is a rogue's gallery of what he saw, right? So there are 11 different clonal solutions to this problem. All but one of them involve multicellularity. One of the lineages still manages to grow single cells in low concentration of sucrose. And it's not that they're cheating on other cells in the same culture because you can make them a clonal isolate and they still have this property. These isolates are all clonal, and what you can see is this is a little bit like what you might expect if the linkages between mother and daughter had a constant probability of dissolving per unit time. It's some very heterogeneous distribution of clump sizes. This, to me, looks suspiciously uniform in size, suggesting that something else is going on. But we have no idea what it is. These guys are at the verge of being macroscopically visible. And coming back to your question about how big do you have to be before you're too big, this is probably getting on towards 1,000 cells. These guys are bigger still. They are macroscopically visible. And what you can see if you look carefully is here the cells are relatively round, and here they're more elongated. And so this is something that yeast geneticists have seen before. People refer to this as pseudo-hyphal growth. Okay. And so on Monday, I said how we found the causative mutations. Does anyone want me to explain that again? And so you can ask which genes got mutated. Okay. So across these 11 lineages, there are 47 genes that haven't, and when I say who's mutated who we impute to be a causal mutation. There are many, many, many other genes that are mutated, but we believe these are just mutations that hitchhiked. So there are 47 genes that have non-synonymous coding mutations. One of the things to say is about a third of these mutations make nonsense codons. Okay? And based on studies that we've done in the past where we looked at what fraction of mutations that inactivate genes do so as a result of nonsense mutations, the suggestion is that almost all of the mutations that we have isolated here are in fact loss of function mutations. We cannot exclude the possibility that one or two of the mutations that have appeared are gain of function mutations, but there's no compelling evidence that any individual mutation that we've recovered has improved the function of a particular gene.
Could you just say briefly how you went from this list of however many genes you found to these ones that you think are likely to be causative?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, this is what you already...
Yeah, but I can do it again. Okay. So here's our evolved strain. There's a large excess of garbage.
Sorry.
Remember?
Yeah, you don't have to say this for
me. Everyone else happy? Okay, well, no, okay, fine. So you should say so. Okay, so we have a bunch of garbage mutations that we believe have hitchhiked, right? That probably outnumber the causal mutations by roughly 10 to 1. We take our evolved strain, we cross it back to a version of its ancestor. So we make a diploid. We go through meiosis, we isolate haploid progeny. We then select on that pool of haploid progeny for them to grow well in low concentrations of sucrose for low density. So we select for the phenotype which we evolved. We have various reasons for believing that all the mutations in this experiment have relatively strong effects, and therefore that the guys who are going to grow well in low sucrose are compelled to have all or almost all of the causative mutations. Okay? Therefore, and so what we do is we take that pool of guys who we've selected, we put them all together, and we sequence their genome at high coverage. And then for every place where the evolved strain differed from the ancestor, we just count in the sequence reads and ask how many come from the evolved strain and how many come from the ancestral strain. For the things that are causal, by the argument I just gave, we expect them to be present at a frequency that approaches 100%. For the garbage guys here, they should literally have a 50-50 probability of ending up in these strains or not. It'll be a statistical distribution around 50-50. And so we count the number of green guys versus the guys who don't have a dot. And if it's below 90%, we argue that they're not causal. And the proof of the pudding is having made these lists of what we think are causal mutations, we re-engineer those mutations back into the ancestral strain, and those mutations only. And we ask if that engineered strain has the property of the evolved strain. And we've done it twice in this particular case, and in both cases they do.
So would you miss things, like what if there are three ways to do this?
Well, so this is...
That picture assumes that there's one way, so
right,
that you have to have that.
Well, this is, remember, this is a clone that we've pulled out of the population, right? So if in the population there are three different independent ways, so the experiment I talked about on Tuesday with the clot, there are actually independent ways of doing it in the population, which is why we pull out clones to do this analysis. In principle, you could have mutations that were functionally redundant with each other, and then you might miss those because you only need one allele or another. So some mutations happen often. This mutation, so one of the things that you might ask is, did we revert the mutation in AMN1 that was made during domestication to make these guys behave as single cells? And the answer is no, we did not. Okay? Presumably because the target size for that reversion is small. In contrast, we mutated another gene that has a role in the transcriptional network that regulates the breakage of the cell wall, a special part of the cell wall that holds the mother and daughter together, and that got mutated in 7 of these clones. We're not surprised. This gene is involved in something entirely different. It is involved in the destruction of proteins that have amino acids at their N-termini that mark them as being supposed to be unstable. It is utterly mysterious to us as to why we see these. There are some genes that are mutated in 2 or 3 clones, but the vast majority are mutated in 1. And roughly speaking, when we look at these genes and we put on our thinking hats and ask, can we account for why mutations in these genes appeared in our experiment? About a third of the guys were like, we think this showed up in this experiment. And if you were a betting person, you might bet 1 or 2 beers that you were right. About a third of them, we wave our hands magnificently, but we wouldn't bet, but we claim that we have some hypothesis, and for about a third of them, we are utterly mystified. You can try and classify genes by which pathways they lie in. So catabolite repression is the phenomenon that when you feed yeast glucose, it basically turns off the genes to metabolize any other sort of carbohydrate because it loves eating glucose so much. And so there are mutations that interfere with this repression. It's not entirely surprising that we find those since these guys are growing on sucrose. If you're a fan of eukaryotic transcription, there is something called the mediator complex, which talks elaborately to RNA polymerase. That's about as much as I understand about it, but you get mutations in this. And you get mutations in growth control, and in particular, the way we interpret these mutations is that in its natural ecology, as nutrient concentrations fall, yeast faces the decision between, should I hunker down and prepare for long periods of starvation, or should I try and eke out one last cell division? Since most yeast cells in the environment must be non-dividing rather than growing with a doubling time of 90 minutes, because if they were, the world would soon be covered with a very thick layer of yeast. It is presumably true that the default decision is like, I think times are going to get worse and stop dividing. In this case, John reliably comes in and refeeds these guys as the carbohydrate concentration drops, and so maybe you should be more of a gambler and be more prepared to divide as the nutrient concentration goes down. And we did a few follow-up experiments that actually suggest that that's what's happening.
Did you look at non-coding variants?
We did. We looked at non-coding variants. We looked for copy number variation. We do not see, with the possible exception of one of the hexose transporters being duplicated in one of the strains, we don't see any indication that there are any causal mutations that are not changes in protein sequence. And remember, as long as these guys are mostly loss of function mutations, the target size for those is enormous, whereas the number of single nucleotide substitutions, which is what the particular mutator we use stimulates, that give rise to changes in the behavior of non-coding DNA is probably actually very small. You know, if we had something that made 100 base pair deletions, if we used a mutagen like that, then you'd presumably kill a lot of promoters.
So do you think if you did this in giant bioreactors or something, you would get a very different mechanism? Because you have pretty small populations, so you can really only take advantage of mutations in large effect.
Yeah, so I think that's an extremely interesting question, and it gets to issues of sort of things like antagonistic pleiotropy and stuff like that. My bet would be that this would mostly occur by the sort of mutations that we see here, because they get so far ahead of everyone else so quickly. But it would be an interesting experiment. There's an experiment that I'm not going to talk about, but it's related to what Christian talked about this morning with genetic compensation. So we remove a gene that is almost essential for cells to polarize their actin polymerase, their actin network, called BEM1. It kills better than 999 out of 1,000 cells. The cells are extremely sick afterwards. We, Arlita Vailan, who was a postdoc in the lab, evolved them to grow better. There is a surprisingly reproducible evolutionary trajectory that multiple clones follow. It involves the deletion, or not the deletion, but the inactivation of three genes. And in that sort of scenario, I would be really interested, at least in principle, of doing the swimming pool experiment and asking, are there other pathways with much smaller target sizes, but which give rise to sort of more efficient suppression? And we just don't know the answer, okay? So this just this is just a graphic demonstration that we can, in fact, recreate the evolved phenotype. So this is the ancestor. This is engineering in the evolved alleles and recreating big Mondo clumps. And this is the experiment of taking that evolved population, which has all these sort of bystander mutations, and making sure they're not causing the phenotype by engineering out the evolved alleles, meaning that we replace them with the wild type alleles and we go back in this direction. Okay. And since Stephen Jay Gould was a great writer about evolution, we get to mention him. So one of the issues that has come up a lot in evolution is arguments about how pathways get followed and do you sometimes get things for free, what's sometimes called pre-adaptation. And he referred to this as span. He wrote a famous thing called the spandrels of San Marco. And for those of you who aren't architectural historians, I'm now going to explain what a spandrel is. So this is a beautiful Renaissance Italian building. It has an upright, and then it has a big heavy piece of stuff across the top, including the roof. To transfer weight from over here so it doesn't buckle here, you put this nice arch there, right? There's nothing required here. This space can be entirely empty, but it's apparently was important to keep stone carvers in full employment at the period. And so you put these nice little panels here and you carve stuff. That's what a spandrel is. And I guess it appeals to our sense of elegance and beauty, so it's good that they did this. And here's the example from our experiment. This is the same enormous clone that I showed. This is what it looks like when you grow it in one millimolar sucrose. When you grow it in the moral equivalent of glucose and fructose, you will notice that the clumps are a lot smaller, right? So if you like, this is the beginning of some environmentally regulated life cycle. And one of the things that a student in the lab is trying to do at the moment is to sort of exploit this and see if we can select for environmental regulation so that in an environment where it's good for cells to stick together, they stick together. And in an environment where it's good for them not to do so, for example, a highly fragmented environment where the issue is trying to inhabit as many of those islands as possible, they disperse like this. Okay.
I don't really understand all the biology, but what would happen if they wanted to go sexual and they were in the clone?
Well, so that's an excellent question. So one of the things that I should have said actually about yeast natural history is the haploid phase of the yeast life cycle in nature is about as short as it is with us. So studies in Saccharomyces paradoxus, which is the sister species of Cerevisiae and hasn't been domesticated, which makes it easier to look at genetic variation in the wild, suggests that 95% of the time when they go through meiosis, the sister spores, their two A's and two alphas, mate with each other. So their motto is vice is nice, but incest is best. So they inbreed extremely strongly. But they also have this thing where they can switch mating types. So if someone fails, you know, one of the alphas is dead, one of the A's will be out of luck, then you have this phenomenon where you can switch mating types, so you can literally mate with yourself. So it sort of depends. If you turned on the HO allele in one of these clumps, they would presumably be able to mate with each other quite effectively. But if one of these clumps is A and one of the clumps is alpha, there are going to be some serious problems, because the guys in the middle are going to be in little monasteries. And again, so having this sort of behavior could be helpful.
When you talk about putting these in different environments, you mean different environments, not by changing the carbon source, by other environmental...
Well, so for example, this particular clump already has this behavior, but the experiment that Zane, the graduate student, is trying to do is to use microfluidics, well, actually not macrofluidics, just make emulsions, because it's just much easier to do technically, where on average each drop will get a single cell. So if you did that with these guys, most of the drops are going to be empty, and some of them are going to have a big giant clump, which probably isn't going to be able to proliferate much because it occupies the whole clump. So there's an advantage to having this lifestyle, and so they should learn to read the cues about the carbon concentration in their environment to tell them what's coming next. So their perfect strategy would be, as the sucrose ran out, the clump should break up because they're about to go into a fragmented glucose environment, and as the glucose runs out, which is the predictor that they're about to go to sucrose, they should start clumping again because they'll be happier like that. Yes?
So one of the strategies for multicellularity that comes up fairly often is facultative multicellularity, like a slime mold type of phenotype.
Yep. That's not what happened here.
No, but you could potentially try to select for that, right? If you have a cell that can be both, one might predict that if you were to select for sex, and the way, and you cannot have sex if you're in a clump, but you can have sex if you're in a small thing, then you might actually be able to evolve the system into a slime mold type of morphology.
Yeah, that's one possibility. One of the reasons that I think we don't select for that sort of stickiness is if you imagine an allele arising. So one of the things in selection is guys have to be able to do well from very low frequency.
Yeah.
If you're the one sticky cell in a vast ocean of unsticky cells, it doesn't help you very much to be sticky. Yes?
If you create two haploids from a diploid and then mate them again together, then you lose diversity with respect to the original.
Well, no, because these guys are inbreeding already, so they have already lost the diversity. Okay, so so although inbreeding is very bad for us and it's very bad for Drosophila, there are organisms that essentially always inbreed. So they include Caenorhabditis elegans, the little nematode, Arabidopsis thaliana, and lots and lots of Ascomycete fungi. Right? And so here's the way I would say it. If you outbreed all the time, one of the things that you accumulate is recessive lethals, because the selective disadvantage of a recessive lethal is the square of its frequency. And so until its frequency gets quite high, it's hard to select against. And the sort of arguments that Mike was making about you can't select at anything which is present at a frequency less than 1/1 the effective population size means it's actually, in the human population, really quite hard to keep recessive lethals at a frequency much below 1%. Okay? So if you grow like that for a long time, and then you do what the royal families of Europe did, then you have problems, right? And then you get Rasputin, Russian Revolution, and stuff like that, right? Because one of the Tsar Alexander, the last Tsar, Tsar Nicholas, one of his children was a hemophiliac, which accounts for the rise of Rasputin and played some role in stimulating the Spring Revolution in 1917. Okay, but if you're always inbreeding, there's very effective selection against recessive lethals because you essentially are mating with yourself. You remove genetic diversity, you expose the recessive lethal, and you eliminate it from the population.
You're still worse than if you'd been always outbreeding in the first place.
Well, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. If you're better off, if you have unlinked mutations that make you fitter, right? So imagine you have mutation A. It has no increases your fitness, not at all. But now you have mutation B, which depends on mutation A, which strongly increases your fitness. In an inbreeding population, you maintain the linkage between those alleles, and they can pass rapidly through the population from a very low frequency. In an outbreeding population, you separate the two alleles, B loses its advantage, and it disappears. So it swings in roundabouts. Is that a fair statement to a population geneticist?
Yeah, it's a reasonable approximation. I mean, if you're selfing, it's only a few generations.
Right. I mean, you know, it has to do with recombination taketh away as much as it giveth, at least over a single generation, in terms of making good genotypes. Yes?
This is something I wanted to ask you during your last talk. Then is it the fact
too
that
late?
Well, you selected for it's clumping. You selected for circadian clock and you found the clumping solution. And is the answer because you had to change so many genes that you had to go through a clumping type of thing for the population genetics to work out?
No, I think in that, I think we were just lazy in that experiment and didn't do it the other way. And eventually, we or someone else will get inspired to do it the other way. And, you know, and we'll find out how much harder it is to actually change the expression of a gene in a single cell so it goes up and down.
No, but since you didn't put any pressure one way or the other, and the clumping solution...
Yeah, it's a little more probable under the exact conditions that we did the experiment than the alternatives solution, but we don't know how much more probable.
But not because of the effect you just mentioned, which is that you can get many genes and a more interbreeding population.
No, because there was no... We at the very beginning of us working on evolution, we were interested in trying to understand why sex exists, right? And because yeast are inbreeding, you have to work to make them outbreed. And it's super hard to control things so that the guys, you are absolutely sure that when you engineer some of the guys to have sex and some not to, that you aren't giving them some accidental disadvantage which is going to corrupt your experiments. And so what I would say is, to a first approximation, experiments on the role of sex in experimental evolution in laboratory have been done by people who are not especially worrying about making their experiments super rigorous. That's changed over sort of the last 10 years, and there are people now trying very hard to do it very carefully. We at least got to a stage where we just decided it was too difficult and we took the British position. Okay. So we're now going to switch, and just as we do, a question that often comes up is, why the hell do they do extracellular sucrose hydrolysis? And there are two possible explanations. One is there is historical constraint. And the other is that even though hydrolyzing sucrose extracellularly is the wrong strategy when you are present in low concentrations of sucrose and low cell densities, it might not always be the wrong strategy for some complicated reason. Yes?
So is invertase completely specific for sucrose as opposed to larger polymers? Because there is a size at which extracellular hydrolysis is the only way to go about. So then you know that invertase is...
Invertase appears to be... So the maltases, of which there's a whole... So in yeast, there's lots of recombination between telomeres of chromosomes and between non-homologous chromosomes, so you can duplicate and spread copies of genes. And so the maltase genes are located at yeast telomeres, and It depends a little bit on your natural isolate, but they typically contain between 3 and 5 different multase genes. And Kevin Verstreppen investigated the biochemical specificity of those, and they're rather different, right? As far as I know, invertase is substantially more specific than that, okay? And it's certainly true. There are isolates of yeast, sometimes referred to Saccharomyces diasticus, which express amylases, which will hydrolyze starch. And, you know, this is obviously of interest in light beer production and things like that. But invertase, as far as I know, doesn't hydrolyze things bigger than disaccharides. Okay?
And yeast ever sort of symbiotic with something where they would want to hydrolyze it for something?
That's a great question. I mean, the problem is we can't be David and Attenborough and, you know, make programs. And here we are, and we have the transponder on the back of the wild yeast, and we see it bounding across. You know, so this is a serious problem. So the experiment that one would really like to do is take a wild isolate, you know, from some Tuscan vineyard, go back to the lab, barcode it, and go and spray it over an acre of the vineyard. So it's exactly the same strain, but it just has some tags on it that you can follow. And now you just go and take samples over time, because there's a big mystery about, so when people make wine, there is yeast everywhere, but it's only about 1 in 100 grapes that goes into the fermentation that has Cerevisiae. Okay? So it starts out, and even in those grapes, it's a minority of the microorganisms. So it starts out as this incredible minority, but it proliferates really fast, it makes ethanol, and eventually no one else is growing, right? So then that stuff, so when you make wine, at the end, there's all this stuff that settles down to the bottom, including all the yeast. And so in a typical vineyard, you just take that and spread it on the field as a fertilizer. It has, you know, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, all that stuff. But if you try and find live yeast in the middle of the Tuscan or, you know, French winter, not so easy. Right? And so Duccio Cavalieri, who used to be one of the fellows at Harvard, has a whole theory about how it survives over winter in the guts of hornets, which there's some evidence for, but certainly not compelling. But so doing this catch and release experiment is probably the best we could do, but it involves genetically modified organisms, so it's a little hard to do it. I mean, Duccio could probably do it in Italy because Italians are relatively sanguine about breaking laws. Yes?
So what do yeast do with the sucrose? So they can take it up?
They cannot take it up. The enzyme is lodged in the cell wall. They convert it to glucose and fructose. Most of the glucose and fructose floats away.
You said they can take it up under some strains.
Thank you.
So if they can't take it up, then they have to do it outside.
Right. So the issue is the laboratory strains we use cannot take it up. John did a survey of natural isolates, some of which can grow as single cells from low sucrose concentrations. He did not do any further analysis before he left the lab. And so one of the questions is, do those use things like some of the maltose importers will import sucrose? So maybe they're turning those on. We don't know, right?
But then if they imported, what do
they do with the invertase in, so in answer to an earlier question, yeast make two forms of invertase. One has a signal sequence and is secreted, and one does not and is inside the cell. There's less inside the cell than out, but there is some inside the cell. Okay? All right. So, actually, let me just go backwards for a bit. Okay, this is fine. So one of the things that's true, so your question was, you know, like, are these guys in the middle starved, right? These clumps are certainly approaching the size where they would be. For sure, these guys are in a different milieu than these guys out here, right? Because there's less glucose, there are more waste products. And so almost certainly these cells are expressing a different pattern of genes than these cells here. They all give rise to progeny. And so the goal, in principle, ought to be, thinking anthropomorphically, for everyone here to optimize their pattern of gene expression relative to their environment so they can produce as many progeny as possible. That optimization will in itself alter the environment still further, and so you get some, if you keep waiting during evolution, you should presumably get more and more differentiation here, right? It's not because the cells, in a sense, are actively talking to each other, exchanging deliberate signaling molecules. They're just modifying each other's environments. But you could argue that if you went on for long enough, you might want to switch that we talk to each other's environments for using some more deliberate form of communication that originally used something that was a metabolic byproduct and then purely becomes a signaling molecule. Okay? So we can imagine that these guys might be have the beginnings of differentiation, at least as an environmental response, with them. And that's actually one of the things that we want to look at.
So this may be slightly off your topic. So how is this different from what happens like in a colony, inside of a, just a colony on a plate, right? Everybody sort of piled on top of each other. The guys in the middle are different from the guys at the edges. So, they're not sticking to each other, but...
No, it's not different from what happens in a colony at all. And the very first thing I tried to do, you know, before the lab worked on evolution, was to work on the basis that in a colony, exactly what you said would be true, and cells should be prepared to help each other because they're genetically identical by kin selection. And now if two colonies of different cells touched each other, maybe they should fight because you don't want to help non-kin. Okay? And so there's all sorts of interesting questions. I guess the question is, how much is a yeast colony on a plate an artifact of evolution? Yeah, and so one thing, you know, a selection you could do, which as far as I know one has ever done, is you propagate cells for a long time by making them grow as, you know, reasonably well-separated colonies, and there's presumably phenotypes you select for, which may have to do with exactly what you're talking about.
I guess I would just get these guys who would normally be growing as single cells, if they're in our labs and we end up growing them in colonies, they have to be able to physiologically do what your clumps are doing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Although in the colony, we do some experiments with David Nelson looking at these range expansions, where instead of starting with a colony from single cells, as yeast geneticists like to do, you start with, you know, tens or hundred thousands of cells, but you just put a drop of yeast on a plate and you watch it go out. And so what happens is the proliferation there is typically confined to the cells on the outside, and the guys in the middle are starved and they're not growing. So it's a little different in that regard.
But it would be really interesting if the guys in the middle, if they're starving, turned on some genes that cause the clump to break up.
Absolutely.
So I was going to ask that in the case where the clusters were suspiciously uniform in size. If it's the one in the middle that's breaking first.
That, it's a great question, and here's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a pleasant, charming, good sense of humor physicist with their own funding to come to the lab and work on that problem. You know anyone? So, no, it's a great problem, right? We just haven't worked on it yet.
I might have missed this. Are these clumps, they're three-dimensional, right? I
mean, they're three-dimensional.
They're three-dimensional clumps, right? So in fact, what we're really talking about is the center.
Yes, you're talking about the center of the Earth.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So I'll try and talk quickly about one last topic. So, and this is Mary Wall, who did the experiments, about to attack a multicellular organism. And so the question here is, how did differentiated multicellularity arise? And so I was just talking about differentiation. I'm now going to give a much more strict and restrictive definition. I'm going to require that differentiation be irreversible, so it'd be like a germline giving rise to a soma. Okay? I understand that in the modern world, no differentiation is irreversible because we can re-engineer cells back into being stem cells, but we're going to ignore that. Okay? And we're also going to define it as the ability of one cell type to promote another cell type's growth. And so the question is, here's an undifferentiated unicellular population. One way in which differentiated multicellularity could arise is first you clump, and the cells do all the same thing. And then you specialize. So now the blue cells are the germ cells, the yellow cells are somatic cells. They do something that helps the blue cells. But if the something they do is the equivalent of secreting invertase and reducing sucrose to a mixture of glucose and fructose, the yellow cells could help the blue cells at a distance. And so if that's true, it is in principle possible to take this alternative path. And so the question that Mary wanted to ask, is there some intrinsic difference between the evolutionary feasibility of these paths? And so she did this by engineering, not by evolution. So she's actually gonna produce all four states that are shown on this slide. So this one got erased by animation, but this is the undifferentiated clumps. And she's gonna compare their behavior. Okay, so we have to engineer divided labor. We need irreversible differentiation, limited somatic cell growth. The somatic cells have to help the germ cells. And so we want a scheme that looks like this. We want germ cells, we want them to grow fast. Occasionally we want them to give rise to somatic cells which grow less and benefit the germ cells. And this is how we do it. So here's a promoter. Here are two short DNA sequences stolen from a bacteriophage, and there are bacterial recombinases that can catalyze recombination between them. The recombinase is called Cre. And so in our germ cell form, the promoter drives a marker protein, so this is just red fluorescent protein, something that's going to make the cells grow faster. This terminates transcription, so we don't have to worry about what's over here. After recombination has occurred, we're now somatic cells because we lack our growth accelerator. We express a different fluorescent protein and we make invertase, which is going to help at a distance, both locally and at a distance. The growth accelerator, so RPL28 is one of the ribosomal proteins. Cyclohexamide is a drug that inhibits the elongation step of protein synthesis, and mutations in this gene make cells resistant to cyclohexamide. And so when we express this mutant form of the gene, in addition to the wild type copy, which is expressed from somewhere else in the chromosome, the cells will grow faster in the presence of cyclohexamide. Once we become a somatic cell, by removing this, the progeny will grow slower relative to the germline. And we've already talked about this ad infinitum. Okay. So now we want to regulate the division of labor, the frequency at which it occurs. So here's the recombinase. It's transcribed only in daughter cells because this promoter is only active in daughter cells. And it's stuck to a part of the estrogen receptor. And in the absence of estrogen, this part of the protein keeps the recombinase in the cytoplasm. And because the DNA is in the nucleus, no recombination is going to happen. If we now add estradiol, it binds to the estrogen binding domain. There's a binding constant, and so we can get graded activity of the recombinase. And this is a cartoon, and Van Gotchling's lab made this object for other purposes and generously supplied it to us. Okay? And so this is just a graph to show that we can actually control both the relevant parameters in this experiment. So this is the conversion rate. This is the rate at which germ cells give rise to somatic cells. These are frequencies, so that's one. And this is the concentration of estradiol, so we get substantial control over the rate at which we produce somatic cells. And this is the relative growth rate of the somatic cells relative to the germ cells. Okay? As we change the concentration of cyclohexamide, so we can regulate this. If you were a population geneticist, you could think of this as being mutation and this as being selection. So in other purposes, Mary has collaborated with David Nelson student, to use this to investigate the balance of mutation and selection and how this differs in spatially structured and randomly mixed populations. Okay? So here's our hypothesis about the relative merits of different strategies. So here is unicellular differentiation. Red is germ cells, yellow is somatic cells, and here is a cheat, okay? And all I mean by cheat is this is a germ cell that never differentiates. So it never gives rise to more slowly propagating progeny, and so it has a proliferative advantage. In addition, because the somatic cells are helping the germ cells at a distance, this cell sees just as much help as this cell does. It proliferates faster. And so it should eventually start to take over the culture, and then bad things will happen because there are not enough somatic cells to produce glucose and fructose for everyone. So you might imagine that this is an evolutionarily unstable way of evolving differentiation because of the susceptibility to cheats. By contrast, here's the multicellular version. So the cheat arises. In this clump, this cheat has an advantage over these germ cells here because it's dividing faster. But because these are lineage-restricted clumps and they must break up, eventually there can only be two sorts of clumps, at least from this particular origin of this cheat, clumps that are all cheats and clumps that are differentiated. That means these cells are further from the glucose and fructose producing cells than the good guys, the germ cells here. And even if we're stirring the culture, there's an unstirred layer between the cells here, there's an unstirred layer around the whole clump. And so these germ cells have privileged access to the glucose and fructose that's being created by hydrolysis relative to these cells. And if that privileged access is a stronger force than the ability of these guys to grow faster, you should be able to hold off the cheats. And to diagram this properly, it's exactly like the sort of thing, again, that Mike was talking about when he talked about population genetics. These guys should arise recurrently and be selected again. So if you looked at very large populations, there would always be some of these guys here, but they can be held at bay. Yes?
Can you just say again, what's the difference between germ and somatic? So are the yellow ones dividing asexually, or are they not dividing?
No, everyone's dividing. So the perfect version of this experiment, the somatic cells would not divide, okay? And we have tried to engineer that version, and it turns out to be complicated because there's crosstalk between the biological systems that regulate cell division and the biological systems that regulate separation between cells. So in this experiment, the red guys are germ cells in the following sense. They divide faster, and they don't produce this differentiated function. The yellow cells are somatic cells. They do divide, but they divide more slowly. So if you looked at the progeny, for example, of this clump over time, and you just grew the population and diluted it periodically, the progeny of these cells, which are dividing slower, must eventually disappear. They'll essentially be outcompeted. Okay?
So what's the point of having yellow cells?
They help the red cells. They're the only cells that can hydrolyze sucrose. Okay? These guys grow fast but cannot perform an essential function for the growth of the culture as a whole. These guys grow more slowly but perform a function that both helps them and helps other guys in the culture. Okay?
Are they growing only on sucrose, or sucrose plus
something else? Only on sucrose. Well, we can do it in different conditions.
So when you say they grow faster, they only grow faster in the presence of their somatic cells.
Right. They don't grow in the absence of their somatic cells if you grow them on sucrose. Okay. All right. So here's the data from the experiment. So Mary engineered cells to cheat by simply removing the recombinase. She made multicellular versions by making a particular mutant that inhibits cell separation and is relatively specific. So this is a chitinase. So the specialized part of the cell wall that joins the mother to the daughter has chitin in it, which you need to dissolve. And she measured, so she repeatedly passaged cultures, and she measured the relative fitness of the converting, that is germ plus soma versus the cheating strain, And S greater than zero means that the cheater is losing. So we're measuring the fitness of the converting relative to the cheating strength. So this is what happens. If we grow them in sucrose, we make clumps. We use different concentrations of estradiol, so I'll remind you that more estradiol is a higher frequency of making somatic cells. If you don't make somatic cells at a very high frequency, it's stalemate. And to some extent, as you make more somatic cells, you actually help the germ cells win. Okay? These are exactly the same cells genetically, but now they're grown in a mixture of glucose and fructose, so now the somatic cells are doing nothing to help the germ cells. They're just slower dividing progeny, and as you can see, as you convert at a higher frequency, the differentiating lineage loses faster and faster. This is the wild-type version, so they grow as single cells. Now they're growing in sucrose, so here as clumps, the differentiating lineage loses. Here as single cells, as we would predict, it loses, and it loses faster the higher the conversion rate is. And the same is true in glucose and fructose. So what this says to us is, at least for this particular form of differentiation, where you're providing some help through the medium, you could have evolved it while you were still single cells, but it would have been an evolutionarily unstable strategy because you would be vulnerable to cheats. It could have happened this way to start with, but to avoid the cheats, you would eventually have to become a multicellular clump, which makes us think it is more likely that you followed the alternative route, that you first made an undifferentiated clump, which would have to be down here, and then differentiation evolved because now you have a built-in solution to the problem of cheating. Okay. That's it.
Still a bit confused about these red and yellow. So the red ones, they can do this. Why do they not want to do the sucrose things for themselves?
It's a good question. We engineered them that way, right? So what one imagines is that there are activities which are more and less consistent with cell proliferation. And so I can give you an example from nature. So there are cyanobacteria that grow by photosynthesis. Some of them also fix nitrogen. The nitrogenases that exist are poisoned by oxygen. Photosynthesis makes oxygen, so it's a little hard to imagine doing both at the same time and place. The cells grow as chains, or the organism grows as chains of cells, and what it does every so often is set aside a morphologically different, specialized cell which will never divide, and that cell differentiates to make what is called a heterocyst, and it is in those cells that nitrogen fixation occurs. So you can imagine the situation where there are activities that are mutually incompatible that you can't have in the same cell. Our example, in a sense, is totally trumped up. Of course, we had to engineer the germ cells to not make invertase. So we're making a model for mutually incompatible activities by engineering. But it's entirely fake in that sense. There's no intrinsic incompatibility between rapid cell division and making invertase. In principle, there's the cost of gene expression of making invertase, but it's extremely small. Yes?
It's related to the first part of the talk. I keep going back to the earlier part. The first part of your talk, you could have done this whole experiment without differentiation and still ask the question of cheating and not cheating. That is, just make invertase. Are you susceptible to cheating if you discovered a clump, or you could import sucrose? And here you would argue that this solution is, again, slightly more plausible because of the cheating question.
Yeah, I mean, there's a paper from Grieg and Trevisano that argues that if you make the density of cells high enough, the guys who can't make invertase cheat. when we do the experiment, we don't get the same result. That doesn't mean their paper's wrong. It just means different strains, different conditions. I mean, it's terrible because I used the word cheating in talking about this. I think there are certain things in biology that people get excessively exercised about because of anthropomorphic concerns. That includes aging, it includes sex, and sure as hell it includes cheating, right? And so I will paraphrase Abraham Lincoln and say you can cheat some organisms all of the time and all organisms some of the time, but you can't cheat all of the organisms all of the time. So that in particular, you know, let's say you decide I don't want to make invertase, right? Because I'm the bad dude, right? If the population has always maintained a high density and there are always invertase producing cells there, as people like Jeff Gore have arranged and done interesting sorts of studies, yes. But if you plate those things at very low density on sucrose containing medium, the cheats are extirpated from the population. And so, like I said, I really believe that a lot of concern about cheating is because we all believe that other people cheated when their papers look more famous than ours, right? And that, yes, it's relevant in certain situations, and it probably influences the biology of some species, but perhaps less than we might expect. I mean, you know, things like social policing in various hymenoptera absolutely occurs, right? Yes?
You started by saying multicellularity evolved 20 independent times and so on. So if you hadn't known any better, you could have said it's 21 times, you just did it. But you know that these cells used to be able to clump and they lost it. How do we know that multicellularity didn't evolve very few times and all the new ones we've seen are in
We don't. We absolutely don't. Right. I mean the you know, when one looks, you know, this is why, you know, you can do hardcore population genetics where you can make models, you can look at genotypes, everything can be relatively tied down and it can be done as rigorous science, right? But for lots of evolution, like, you know, how often flight evolved or multicellularity, you get to do serious hand waving because you make trees, right? And then you make arguments like parsimony about how things evolved, whereas in fact it could have been that things went back and forth and there's a single origin of multicellularity and that's all there is to it. And we, you know, lots of stuff is, you know, I guess what I would say, okay, let me put it the following way. If there was a single common origin of multicellularity and it just got extirpated so many times that it looks to us like it wasn't, you might expect the mechanism that supported multicellularity would have been conserved and that plants and fungi and animals are essentially the same. As far as we know, in terms of how cells are stuck together, there is absolutely no evidence that that is true. And so if you add that to parsimony, you know, I guess if I'm going to go and meet my maker, I'm happy to put $1,000 on multicellularity evolved many times. Okay? Oh, I could be
except
wrong.
Except that now we know that some cohesins, or I forget the names, are involved in plants and animals, and then in Inyaki's funny snail parasite, facultative multicellular eukaryotes. So it's starting to look closer to what you just said. But, you know, these are distant homologs, and so it's hard to say. But
it could evolve independently from the same genes. It doesn't necessarily...
Yeah, no, I know.
You can use the same machinery but evolve independently.
Yeah, that too. But it's problematic.
Yeah, I guess there's all sorts of stuff in biology. I mean, this is why we do experiments in lab, because, like, trying to figure out what happened to this sort of thing in evolution, I think much of it is going to remain bar talk. And there will be, you know, evidence will be accumulated where some of it will move out of the reign of bar talk to the point where the evidence is compelling and people would bet serious amounts of money. But, I'll, you know, I'm not that optimistic about much of biology in this, or the history of biology. I'm sorry. I'm optimistic that we can understand function and structure in present-day organisms given enough time and effort, although I would argue very strongly we understand far less than we claim. But understanding what happened in the past, I think, is a seriously difficult problem.
Andrew, you criticize parsimony, and that's true. The problem...
No, I mean, it's the best... It's one of the better things we have available.
I mean, it is, because we don't know... The reason why we use parsimony is so we minimize the number of events on the tree. If you know the the probability of transition from one to the other, then you can...
Absolutely.
And if experimentally somebody can show that it's quite easy to go from one state to the other, then it's even less surprising to see that it evolves several times. There's an iteration between experiments and re-explaining the things.
I guess, I mean, we can have different levels of educated pessimism and optimism. So, you know, we can measure transitions in the laboratory. And then the question is, like, how confident should we be about exporting those frequencies, you know? And you know, knowledge is always provisional. I'm not arguing that parsimony is wrong or anything. I'm just arguing looking backwards into time in general is a difficult problem. That's all.
I don't know. I agree. I'm just saying that what we have now is parsimony, but with more biological knowledge,
absolutely
transition.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, hopefully we will get better over time, but certainty will be elusive.
But if losing multicellularity is a million times more likely than gaining it, then you can fit the data on the tree much differently than the parsimony.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. When you know the transition.
My claim is that as soon as you've learned how to do it once, then the rate from unicellular to multicellular changes the first time. I mean, there are many cases where the first time you discover something is rare, and subsequent back and forth can happen at high rates.
Well, that's if the world were in equilibrium after 3.5 billion years of evolution, right, it'd be exactly, by definition, it has to be exactly the same number of transitions from unicellular to multicellular back and forth. It's just that the equilibrium of one would be really low, it's more opportunities for transitions. The other guy's really high, the rate of transition is lower. But
you should also be able to see that, right? I mean, if the reversion from multicellularity is a high probability event, then when you look at phylogeny, you should see many sort of a patchwork or a checkerboard sort of set of examples, right, which you see, for example, with plastids. Right? You pick up plastids, you can lose them, you can replace them, that's fine. But you don't see a lot of unicellular embryophyte.
Well, that may be because the world's not in equilibrium. I wasn't saying I believe in that argument, I'm just saying...
But I'm saying that there's, rather than having to speculate, I mean, you can look at some of those and say, we're not finding a lot of single-cell green algae that then all of a sudden go inside the embryophyte phylogeny.
Well, when people, as Andrew said, when people talk about the origin of multicellular, we're not talking 20 times, right? That's not a big number across the whole tree of life. And depending on how you count, you might come up with a number of complex multicellular, and depending on where you draw the line, that could be a two. Right? Yes. So you only require two going in the other direction. It's a hard problem, I totally agree with it. I'm not sure we'll get anywhere by arguing.
Bigger than some of these other major transitions. Like it's if origin of life is once and origin of eukaryotes is once, then 20 starts to seem big on that kind of scale. It's somehow it's easier than some of these other things.
No evidence for that. The 20, I'm saying you should discard the 20. The 20 all came, there's no evidence that they didn't come after the same unique one. That's
the
That's why I was
heading
off the pass.
How do you know the last eukaryote common ancestor was not facultatively multicellular?
But then that would mean the entire protist lineage essentially
was. Parasites lose things all the time.
But protists are not all parasites, though.
If the rate of mitochondrial loss was high enough, then we would have deposited lots of independent mitochondrial things on the same trees. I mean, very close. It just happens to have accidentally happened only in certain lineages.
Yeah,
Well, that's exactly what people used to posit, and then they actually got the cell biological data to show that all of these other organelles are derived mitochondria. So we may do that. But so are people looking, for example, at the brown algae in the same way? I mean, we've got Nectocarpus genome, but are people now looking at the mechanisms? Because that's another good third example of really differentiated multicellularity, not slime molds, not whatever. Because you guys brought up integrins. Mm-hmm. Are they involved? I just hadn't been following.
I only work in the laboratory. Okay. Meaning, no, I mean, I'm embarrassed. I don't know anything about that. I'm a physicist in biologist clothing.
This is being recorded. Okay.